Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Inside the Hive, the inaugural podcast featuring myself, Joe Hagan, and Emily Jane Fox.
We got the keys to the kingdom.
The keys to the kingdom. I feel like we're on the Enterprise, but Captain Kirk is not here to show us how to press the buttons.
Well, we'll show him in theater, right?
Yeah, we're going to go to light speed.
This is like the extent of any of my star knowledge. I've never seen Star Wars or Star Trek.
You know, at this point, it's probably too late for you.
It is. I think I've missed the boat. I have a gigantic gap in my cultural knowledge, and I'm totally fine with it.
Well, let's check back in maybe 30 or 40 more days of quarantine and see if your mind has been changed.
Honestly, anything could happen.
Yeah, I just looked at the calendar. I wanted to add it up. It's been 46 days since we've been in lockdown, or at least I have.
That feels both way too short and way too long.
It's true. It's warping time in all kinds of interesting ways. And we seem to be, both the news is flowing fast and hard, and yet we seem to be having Groundhog's Day every day of our lives at the same time.
It's true. I think the weeks feel really fast. By the time we get to Friday, I'm like, how did that happen? But the days feel like years.
It's like Groundhog's Day if it had been written by Dostoevsky. I just feel like I'm in this like Russian novel that is just never going to end.
That's perfect. Can I say something controversial?
Please.
Every day I have existential dread. I have dread about our political situation. I have dread about our public health situation. I really miss my family greatly. I miss being able to be in the same room with my colleagues. I miss the way that we usually conduct business. We are in an industry where so much of what we do is face-to-face and getting to meet new people. That's, I think, why we both love doing what we do. But I'm having a really lovely time at home. I think what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to make the best of it. Every night before I go to sleep, my boyfriend and I tell each other what we're grateful for.
Oh, that's great.
It sounds very cheesy.
No, it's...
But I think it makes a difference. Yeah. And they're very small things. They're very small, usually. But I think it helps change your perspective before you go to sleep. And so you wake up in the morning and you're like, okay, I have things to be grateful for. I want to, throughout the day, make note of what I'm grateful for so that at night we're not just searching for random things.
You know, not only is that lovely, I think it's very true. You know, I look around on social media, the only way I can connect with anybody anymore, and you're seeing everybody's kind of getting in touch with themselves and in their humanity and their eccentricities mm-hmm. as well. You know, we've got Nick Bilton baking his sourdough bread, you know. I've been
so much bread.
Probably playing more ukulele than I had ever expected to play at this point. And
cool.
Yeah, that's been happening. I mean, you know, there it is, and time, we have the time and the space, so let's do this.
You also shaved your head.
You know, I did. I finally kind
of... I'm looking at it now.
I did that. You know, I put a little Twitter poll on. I said, is this a thing that should happen? 55% said do it.
Wow, you really skated on the margin. If I got a poll that suggested a physical change and I only got 55%, I would be very bold to take that change. Yeah.
Well, I was probably... going in that direction already. So I just needed an excuse. You know, I needed a little encouragement.
Great.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we're Zooming right now so she can actually see the results of mm-hmm. that. And that
you should post, you need to post a picture for your 55% of those, and maybe the 45% will be changing there too.
You know, we'll see. Maybe we'll, yeah, we'll have to see what the judgment is in percentages later on. So
you're also doing something else that's very cool on Instagram.
Me. Right? Yes, I.
Yeah.
Well, so listen, you know, everybody has time now to like organize their sock drawer, and I alphabetized my record collection, right? And so then I began to think I'm going to just play some of these records for people and live stream them. And this is a kind of thing that if you saw this before the coronavirus pandemic, you'd be like, I don't have the time for that. Suddenly people have the time and they're actually watching and listening to me play these records, which I'm grateful to be able to do for them. It's usually something I would have just done alone in my living room with maybe a couple of friends or something. But
so quarantine has taken a solitary activity for you and brought it to the masses.
I guess that's really true. I guess that's true. And I'm also just looking for an excuse, or I'm trying to justify this expansive record collection that I accumulated over the years, which...
If you want me to justify anything you spent money on, I'm your person. I can justify any money expense.
Yeah, I like that. Well, I hope that you... And I keep doing it. In fact, just yesterday, I received another record that I ordered off eBay from Japan. And I let it sit.
What did you order?
Yeah, I let it sit in quarantine for 24 hours, you know?
As you do. What's
it was
the
a Count Basie record. Yeah, I've been going back to the classics. I'm trying to just listen to music that is delightful because...
What delights you now in quarantine or in self-isolation?
Things that delight me. Well, I'm delighted by listening to music and sharing music and then listening to what other people are listening to. And, you know, there are some really annoying things, you know, Facebook demands that you post 10 of your favorite records. I can't imagine there's anybody out there that hasn't come across this. It's like one of these, you know, you're going to have like 10 friends that demand that you post all your favorite records. And I don't necessarily want to do that. But
do you comply?
You know, I have done it in the past, but you know, you're just sort of spinning your wheels. I don't know. I'm ambivalent about social media. You know, there was the one where everybody posted a picture of yourself when you're 20. Did you see this one going around?
Did you do that? I did. Yeah, it was inescapable.
Yeah, it was inescapable. I did it too. It was humiliating, but I did it anyway.
I'm non-compliant with those things. If I get tagged in those things, I just don't do it. And that maybe makes me a bad citizen of the internet, but it makes me a saner person, I think.
I think it means you have a strength of character. I really do.
Well, I don't have Facebook. So I have Instagram, so I'm really not on the moral high ground. It's the same thing. I just, you know, there are some things that people don't need to see from me. And what I'm listening to, a 10 push-up challenge, no one needs that from me.
Can you do 10 push-ups?
It's unnecessary. I'm stronger than I look, Jack. Yeah.
Well, I did hear a rumor about you, which is that you once ran a marathon in under 3 hours. Is this true?
I did. I did once do that.
That's extraordinary.
I run every day. It's my thing. Yeah. It's my thing. And it's been such an amazing thing during quarantine to be able to have the hobby and activity that I love the most to still be able to do that. And I wear a mask now when I run, which is a real cardio challenge.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
But it's nice. It's nice. I mean, today I'm stuck in Los Angeles right now, and I have been for quite some time. And it is more, I think it's going to be 94 degrees today.
Wow.
So
now, as somebody who's on the East Coast still experiencing a sort of spring chill, I am I'm jealous. And but you know, we're all basically in the same place in a strange way because we're all inside, right?
That's true.
So odd. So we're going to pivot now to the news of the day. Look how long we managed to go without talking about the news. It was kind of...
I feel like that's the longest I've managed to go without talking about the news in a really long time. So yeah. Good on us.
That felt good, you know?
I feel real... Look, I feel good. Waking up in the morning, you practice what you're grateful for. Yeah. I'm grateful now for that stretch of time that we just took not talking about the news. Right.
Well, we're going to go into some news, but we're going to go in gently.
Okay.
Today, we're going to have an interview, my interview with Chris Matthews.
I can't wait to hear.
Oh my gosh, Chris Matthews. So, you know, a subject of some controversy. So this week, I talked to Chris Matthews. He, of course, anchored MSNBC's Hardball for 20 years until he retired last month, the day before Super Tuesday, which now seems like a lifetime ago. But
Wow.
Yeah. I was sort of nervous to bring him on. You know, he left under a little bit of a cloud of controversy, right?
But you talk about it in the interview.
I do. He addresses it. And it wasn't just that controversy. There were others. But, you know, a GQ article came out. You know, a guest of his from 4 years ago, a woman named Laura Bassett, described some sexist comments he made in the makeup room 4 years ago, and that rattled her before she was going to go on air. And it was sort of, you know, one of those semi-lecherous things that, you know, unreconstructed males of a certain age say, but you don't expect from a professional TV host. But in this case, he said it. And it wasn't the first time. And so, you know, as one of Chris's colleagues told me, he's become generationally off. And this was an example of that. And yeah, and he had another.
What else are you hearing as you, I know that you talk to a number of colleagues, yeah, people who work in the building. And I will say that I'm an NBC News and MSNBC contributor. Right. So I'm obviously not anywhere near the building right now because no one is. But there are, I'm sure, lots of people talking and lots of people willing to talk to you about what went down last month.
Right. Well, listen, he had had a series of gaffes. I think there was, you know, three in a row. So it was a little bit of a three strikes thing. But and one of them was when it was the night of the Nevada primary. He compared Bernie Sanders' victory to the Nazis taking over France during World War II. And that got him in some hot water and he apologized. And he addresses that also today. But people at MSNBC tell me, you know, he had a lot of allies in the building. A lot of people liked him. They didn't consider him a lecherous guy. They considered him a pretty benign, you know, happy-go-lucky guy, and they relied on him to be sort of the anchor of on election nights. But, you know, if anybody's been following the news, knows that at NBC has had all kinds of problems. They had Matt Lauer episode. They had the Harvey Weinstein story that Ronan Farrow has said NBC, you know, squelched the reporting about his offenses. And so, you know, this was a company that wanted to project a zero tolerance attitude about this kind of behavior. And so he was asked to leave early. He wasn't forced off the air. He was basically just pressured to retire early. He was supposedly going to retire later anyway.
How old is he?
You know, that is a good question. And it's information that you would think I would have at my fingertips.
I feel like, you know, like he's generally in his 70s.
He is 74 years old. Thanks to my Google brain, I was able to bring that up very quickly.
Love Google. Love
right.
Google.
So, and whatever else you want to say about Chris Matthews, okay, he's a very talented TV improviser. He has this incredible depth of historical knowledge. He was sort of a pioneer of the way cable news addresses politics, for better or worse. You know, he kind of demystified it and cast it as like a series of, you know, power plays and showed people how it works. And he'd been a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter. He was an aide to Tip O'Neill back in the 80s. And he's kind of one of these great Irish Catholic dinner table talkers. And in that way, he's not unlike Joe Biden, another Irish Catholic, you know, who has a feel for the working class and who also puts his foot in his mouth. You know,
I was going to say loose lips.
Loose,
right?
That's right. And so I wanted to find out, you know, what Matthews might have been saying on TV, let's say in the last month as our world has been turned upside down, about the political fallout. And, you know, as you'll hear, and as you're about to hear, he was eager to address the elephant in the room right off the top. So let's listen now. Chris Matthews. Hello, welcome to Inside the Hive.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you coming on. This is our inaugural episode of our relaunched podcast under new management. That's myself and Emily Jane Fox. And I'm happy that you agreed to do this. Thank you.
Well, these are podcasts of the future, I guess. I mean, I did six of them for MS and called Say You Want to Be President. And actually, I love doing them because, well, you get some time and you can think. It's the pace you can think at. It's pretty good that way.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to doing some thinking on the mic here. starting with you, you know, trying to think on the fly anyway.
That's what I did for 26 years. I tell you, it's a world to live in. You know, I lately I've discovered something new in my life. It's called sundown. Actually, I go for these.
That's right. You're home
walk.
At hours that you haven't been home in years. Yeah.
26 years. I've never really, except on a weekday, I haven't been able to see how nice. I love the sundown. I mean, it's just a great time of day around 7 o'clock, and especially this kind of weather. It's great down here in Maryland. And, you know, I go for these long walks, and I think I've lost about 10 or 15 pounds. I look great compared to what I was. I mean, who knows? It's all good.
Well, so you were you retired from Hardball a month and a half ago. I just calculated it.
March,
51 days.
March 2nd, yeah. I was down in Charleston. It was a Friday, the 28th of February, and I was going to do the show, and I did do the show, and I was supposed to stick around for the primary, and I was going to go to Texas on Tuesday to cover the Super Tuesday out of Texas because everybody else was out in California. And then I heard about this online article that said that reported that 4 years ago I complimented someone who was sitting in the makeup chair getting ready for the show. And I said, as I said on Hardball, when I ended the show that Monday night, those comments are inappropriate in a workplace. And that's what happened.
Yeah. Can you, you know, tell me like what, how did it go down? How did that happen?
Well, pretty much what I just said. I mean, I didn't argue about it. I didn't deny it. I had vaguely remembered it, I guess, and I accepted the credibility of the complaint and the article. I didn't want to challenge the person who made the complaint or wrote the article. I thought it was very credible and certainly within the person's rights to write that article. Of course, that was highly justified. And you know, I it was inappropriate in the workplace to compliment somebody on their appearance. And this was in the makeup chair, and I did it. More is there to say? What more is there to say on this, Joe? I can't think of anything.
Right.
But, you know, that was a month and a half ago, and so much has changed. And, you know, back then, the Democratic Party was going into the South Carolina. We knew that Biden would do well down there because of his strong support from Jim Clyburn, who's a very influential leader down there and should be. And all of a sudden, what had been a campaign where Biden looked like he was lost, till he came back so strong in South Carolina that it empowered him through all across the country on Super Tuesday in a way that no one – I had heard that. Some of the Biden people had said that was going to happen, that everything would change because of South Carolina. I was highly skeptical because Biden had not done well at all in Iowa or New Hampshire, and certainly not in Nevada, where he came in with a weak 19%, I believe. And so, you know, it was, you know, politics has two great things about it. One, you can study history and get a pretty good look at what's probably going to happen. And the other part of politics, Joe, you know, is it totally phenomenal. I mean, things happen that just, my God. Was that going to happen? Nobody was predicting that. And it's like Trump in 16. You know, Michael Moore predicted it, but, you know, Michael Moore has a pretty good insight into the working guy and woman in the Midwest and industrial areas. And I think that most people completely missed that one. I think politics is, I think this fall it's going to be, I'm not going to say it's going to be close. I don't know if it's going to be close. I don't know, because I look at, Trump's advantages in money, and he owns the microphone, he owns the camera. He has ability to make news and to do things in the last month of the campaign that no challenger can do. And at the same time, I think that he will be blamed for the economy, and that's why he's very concerned about getting the economy on an upward slope by late summer, I guess. And
Chris, you said something interesting when you before you left in your final kind of speech when you were retiring in the evening of March 2nd, which I thought was a really, you said some really candid things. And one of the things you said was that the younger generation's out there ready to take the reins. We see them in politics and media fighting for their causes. They're improving the workplace, you said. And I thought that was a pretty candid acknowledgement of what was going on at the time, but also just more generally. And, at the time, the issue was, for a hot minute, it looked like Bernie Sanders was going to be the nominee. And on the air, you were pushing back on that. You made at least one comment that got you into some hot water. You apologized for that, but you weren't alone in this. James Carville out there warning.
Let's not go over that again. But that when things get distorted, you have to deal with it.
Yeah, and I understand. But you were out there, and James Carville also, and other people were sort of pushing against Bernie Sanders, and is it fair to say that you were, and MSNBC, I think broadly, was skeptical and critical of Sanders and maybe even pro-Biden, really?
You think so?
Going into that.
Who was pro-Biden? What's that? Who was pro-Biden on primetime MSNBC?
Well, that's what I'm asking. I'm asking whether you...
Joe, you just said that we were pro-Biden. Who was pro-Biden?
I'm asking whether you were.
Give me one. you're proposing something.
Well, there was some talk of the Bernie's followers being brown shirts and, this sort of radical thing, the revolutionary energy of the, and his message.
In all fairness, there was that side argument about behavior by certain supporters. Yeah. I don't think I think I look at things in political terms and also ideological terms. And I think that my concern, there's a couple concerns. First of all, history. Let's go back to history. I was there at the Democratic Convention in 1972. And I watched the excitement about George McGovern, who was a good guy, a really good guy. And he was getting the thrill, the excitement of people down there in Miami Beach, people dancing. I remember John Kenneth Galbraith, the economist, dancing in a circle, and a guy from Holy Cross, a guy named Kay Moynihan. They were thrilled that they had won the nomination against a moderate, Ed Muskie. And 49 states later, it was over. It was a disaster. And I think the parties, American parties, have been mostly successful when they've been able to grab the middle, because the middle sits there. I think there is a sweet spot in American politics. I noticed it in one of Bloomberg's ads. His campaign didn't work, but one of the ads was very effective because it talked about Jack Kennedy, the president, and Ronald Reagan, the president. And somewhere in there, people on the left, or I don't know, the right, don't want to hear it, but there is sort of a sweet spot there in American politics, somewhere there between Jack Kennedy and Reagan, where the American people is very happy to be. And this is not left and right. This is not the advocates or the activists. This is where the country tends to settle down. And the closer you can get to that, I think the smarter the politics. I think that's something that I've been thinking about a lot, because I've been through these. When you go through these campaigns, and you also see how effective the Republicans are at destroying a candidacy. If you saw what they did to Dukakis, who was a good guy, a clean as a whistle, governor of Massachusetts, in many ways, a very classic sort of Yankee reformist politician. They turned him into a foreigner. They just treated him like this strange card king. Remember the ACLU, and wouldn't salute the flag and all that terrible. And it turned 25% of the people around. That election went from 17 points for Dukakis to 8 points against him. And then actually at one point in October was worth it. Same thing with swift voting John Kerry, who went over and got shot at over in Vietnam. They turned him into some kind of problem in his war record. So when you take a guy like Bernie Sanders to go into a general election, you can just imagine, because they're going to do the same thing I don't think so effectively with Biden. Where do you see how they use their money? Because Biden's numbers are 49-42, the latest polling on NBC. And I got to tell you, that's a decent margin. But you watch and see.
That's a decent margin.
What they're going to do. Because, see, Trump is still 46% and holding strong in approval. That number hasn't changed, according to on Chuck this weekend, Chuck Todd. 46% is sitting there. It's basically enough to basically, within striking distance of winning the Electoral College, very close. If you take away California and New York and some other states, it's basically Electoral College 50-50. So what happens if a Bernie gets situation goes in that with his record and his foreign policy stuff he said over the years? They just croak him. But I don't know. I mean, there's nothing, you never know. If the economy stays bad, I mean, Bernie has been very believable. He's very credible. People think he's honest. He says what he believes. But what I was watching was history possibly continuing what I'd seen early on in my political career. When I was working for the DNC as a volunteer and I was working for a senator down there in Miami, I saw that excitement about it. And sometimes the excitement on the left is the excitement of beating the center left. And sometimes the excitement on the far right is beating the center right. And they missed the general election. And look what's happened now.
You know, the election and everything has been upended by this pandemic, obviously. And suddenly you're seeing that Sanders' ideas suddenly seem possibly more relevant. You know, we got this like virtual socialism going on just because of the situation we're in economically and health-wise. And you're seeing the Obama endorsement of Biden tipped its hat very strongly to the progressive ideas that Bernie had brought in.
I know. We'll see.
You know, I think that's my question for you is...
Well, there's a real difference in this country. There's a fight, and it's not going away, between the individualist American culture, the cowboy culture, if you will. I want my own house. I want my own car. I want to own a gun if I want to own one, to the more social, which is more like, well, we are in this together. And obviously the Democratic Party is more of the latter, and the Republican Party and Trump is with the former. That cultural fight basically is right down the middle in the country. And I think that, you know, you're seeing with which states like Georgia and Tennessee and Texas want to open up faster, South Carolina, and you have states like California under Newsom and Maryland and Massachusetts and New York, and those states being very concerned with public safety and very concerned with the vulnerable people. That's a real cultural battle, really. And it's American. It's in our gut, that battle. It's not going to go away. And will this tilt to a more social point of view? I don't know. I mean, I saw Bernie's op-ed the other day, Senator Sanders' op-ed. I know he's making that case. But, you know, some people make the same case all the time, and they just use conditions to make the argument. But this, it's always the same case. Senator Sanders doesn't trust corporations. He doesn't like them. He's made it clear whether it's fossil fuels or it's healthcare industry or it's pharmaceuticals. You know, he's a democratic socialist, and that's his point of view, and he's going to apply it wherever conditions apply, and I think that's what we're seeing right now. Look, I don't know what's going to happen on that front. I think Biden's going to Biden's careful. He's got to be very careful, Biden, to look strong. I think if Trump wins this election, and I still think that's a bit a minority point of view. If he does win, it's because of strength, perceived strength as a person, as a leader, tough leadership.
He's calling the pandemic an invisible enemy. Right. And he's refashioning himself as a kind of, or trying to anyway, as a Churchillian leader for a crisis. Right. I mean, you're a history buff. I mean, what does real leadership look like? And what is it? Is Trump having any success there?
Well, let's go back to that for a minute. I want to finish on Biden. Biden's danger with regard to Sanders is that, you know, when you look like you have bowed to the person you beat, Nixon made this mistake in 60 with Nelson Rockefeller. He cut a deal, and it looked like Nelson Rockefeller wrote the Republican platform in 60 on civil rights, et cetera, the other things. And it looked like he was really weak. You have to look like, and Carter and Ted Kennedy in 1980, it looked like Ted Kennedy was writing the platform. You can't make it look like somebody else is the boss. So as he finesses his relationship with Bernie and his supporters, he has to be very careful that he's the boss. He has to. Harry Truman did this very effectively when he rejected the Henry Wallace supporters, the progressives in 1948. You have to be the leader. Strength, if Trump wins, it's going to be on the issue of strength. Now, Trump's weaknesses are, and the reason why Cuomo looks so good and Gavin Newsom looks so good, and others like Whitmer of Michigan, and they look good because they're dealing with decisiveness up front. They moved quick. They were honest with the facts. They got the facts to the people. They showed empathy. Cuomo talking about his mother, Matilda, has been very effective connecting him with the 2% that are vulnerable. And most importantly, the decisive. So it's empathy, decision, honesty, and visibility. Now, Trump is very visible. But the others are right. Much better on those other issues, and I think that that's where Cuomo's look good, and Newsom's look very good. And by the way, all the three governors I mentioned, including Mike DeWine, a Republican of Ohio, have doubled their job approval since the pandemic. So it's not just that they were popular because they're from Democratic states or moderate Republican areas, but they win because their people are being honest with people, and this is really important. And Trump has not done well in that regard, and I think in the end, he may open up too soon. He closed down too late. These things are going to hurt him, obviously. But in the end, it's going to be, you know, Joe, October 15th. Is the economy getting better? Does it look like we're out of it? I mean, the American people tend to look for a light at the end of the tunnel. And what's it going to look? Reagan got reelected with Morning in America. You know what the unemployment rate was when Reagan got reelected? 7.2. So it wasn't like things were better. It was just they felt better and they were getting better. And that's where people want right. to be. I think if I were Trump, I'd want to know that the Dow's going up. I'd want to know that people are not getting sick again. There's not a second wave. A second wave could be very much, it'll be tragic, but also have political consequences.
3, 2, 1. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is going to get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED Politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Hive.
You know, you mentioned the word empathy. And I was thinking about an article I saw in the Post. It was actually from last year by a professor at University of Texas about FDR's response to what went on, after the Great Depression. And it said here that he made a difference during a time of despair, deprivation, confusion, and shock, and how? By offering frightened listeners empathy. And I think about that being a major deficit for Trump. And yeah. Basically what seems to be Joe Biden's so far, you know, sell at this point yeah. is that he has
well,
that empathy.
Well, let's do that because you're onto something I care a lot about. And there's a great poll question. There's two great poll questions. One is, are we going in the right direction? That usually tells you, no matter what, no names mentioned, no candidates' names mentioned. When you say, are we going in the right direction? That's a key question for the incumbent, generally. The incumbent, you better be going roughly in the right direction. Number two, does this candidate or president care about people like you? People like you.
Right.
As I said, I think Mario's son, and he is in many ways Mario's son, Andrew Cuomo, is very good at talking about family terms. He says, it's not the 2% we're going to lose to deaths, to mortality. It's my mother. And
right.
I think that's my mother, Matilda. He gave her a name. And they have a thing in that family where they call their parents by their first names, but that's their family peculiarity. But I think that's what I meant. Eddie Rendell, who was probably the best mayor we've ever had in Philadelphia, if you read Buzz Vissinger's book, it's about the scene I never forget is Eddie Rendell sitting in the family room of a hospital, sweating it out 3 in the morning with the family of a police officer who was shot in the line of duty. That gets me, that is what politics really is. It's sitting with a family of somebody serving the public and gets shot and you don't know whether they're going to make it or not. And that gets, you know, there's so many ways that Amy Klobuchar would talk in the campaign about the guy who said, the working guy who said, who loved FDR. And they said, what, did you know the guy? Said, no, but he knew me.
Right.
And I think Amy had it right about the way people want a president. They want somebody who, if they were in your shoes, they'd be on your side. I mean, not on your shoes. If they knew you, they'd be on your side. And it goes back to like LaGuardia, the mayor of New York, during a strike of the newspaper delivery truck drivers. And he read the comics to people on Sunday because he knew it wasn't just the kids who read the comics. Everybody read the comics. And Dick Tracy and all that. And it was a way of just showing, I get it. And I think that's something Trump has a problem with. There's no doubt about it. There's no, and that's just who he is. You know, he's worried about he's worried about his name being on the check. Come on. There's a great line at the end of the movie, one of my favorite movies, that Dave, of course, about the guy pretending to be president, Kevin Kline. And at the end of it, he gives a speech. He said, there's certain things you ought to expect from a president. He should care about, I should care more about you than I care about me. And that's a very high standard. Of course, we generally don't think our politicians are that good of people to say they care more about us than them. But that is the ideal. That's what you look for in a leader. Somebody who really gives a damn. And I think that that's what you're at. And I think Biden will come across on that. Again, though, you got to go back to strength. He has to look strong going up. He has to stand up against him on the floor in that studio. And I hope to hell they don't have a studio audience. I hope to hell we can finally have to go back to debates with just the two candidates, like Nixon and Kennedy, one person against another person, 10 feet apart or whatever, and actually take on each other intellectually, rhetorically, and soul to soul, and who looks the person you want as your leader, not a bunch of stupid applause in the audience. And I think that'd be a great change.
Do you know Joe Biden?
Yeah. I know him.
Tell me.
I'm riding on the train with him, with being to all his family funerals of every St. Patrick's Day when he was vice president. In fact, as recently as a year or two ago, he would have us all at breakfast for all the Irish Americans, to, you know, people like, you know, Maureen Dowd, Mike Barnicle, you know, the crowd. And they were all, you could have been there, Joe. And he would have, it was just Irish breakfast with the Taoiseach, or the Prime Minister of Ireland would be there, or somebody, and some Irish political leaders, Terry McAuliffe and people. But he's sort of like that. He's a very good schmoozer. Everybody on Amtrak who works in the cafeteria car and all that, they all know him by name. He takes pictures of them all. He's a good street corner politician, like Tip O'Neill was. He's good at meeting people of all backgrounds and finding something in common with them, human to human. I think that's what he's always been good at. And he represents a state, by the way, that's as small as a congressional district. So he basically could get to know everybody, a lot of people. So But a large African, but it's something people don't know, a large African-American community there in Wilmington. And I think that may explain his good chemistry, like Bill Clinton's chemistry, with people of African-American backgrounds. I mean, it's a generalization, of course, but I think he is very comfortable in that setting, social setting. I think he is.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, people say, he's a great retail politician. He likes to get out and mix it up with people. He's great with people. He's got good chemistry. But now we're in a world where that may not be possible. You know, even though he's basically not broken through in the kind of day-to-day messaging, you know, like you said, Trump kind of has command of the media right now. He's sort of been, you know, the invisible man in the last few months, and yet still kind of crushing Trump in some crucial polls. But, you know, it can't go on like this, right? He's got to tangle with Trump. He's got to energize voters. And, you know, he's not connecting to people under 30 is what we're hearing. We're looking at the polls.
And I know that the turnout wasn't what Senator Sanders thought it was going to be among young people. And young people eventually are going to vote. I know that'll happen. There's all used to say you had to get married to get really into a regular practice of going to church and all that. And those are the old conventional notions of when people sort of get engaged politically. But people go to college. Some of these, where you can vote. Some of the states where you're allowed to vote, and whether you vote on campus or not, or they make it difficult in some places. You know all this, Joe. It's, they can play a lot of voter repressive games there. And, you know, you have to go back and vote in your own state. Well, that's a problem for a kid who's a young 18-year-old at college. Just get on a plane and bomb home and vote. I mean, you know, this whole question about are we going to be voting by mail is an issue, a real issue, because we've had some people are very suspicious. Republicans, especially suburbanites, are very suspicious of big city political organizations and what they can do and in terms of manipulating a mail system. Whereas a person who lives in the burbs, so what's the big difference? It's my address. I'm mailing it from my neighborhood. Of course it's me. Of course I'm the one. Whereas it's some ward leader doing it, they go, wait a minute, who actually filled out this form? But I think we're going to end up with something like mailing. We're going to have to. I really think that's coming. Right. So,
yeah.
And that's going to be a question for young people, too. Young people have to. Going to a rally is different than going to a voting booth. And I've always thought about why is it that it's easier to imagine going to an event than to go. And some of it is once you get to be a certain teenage year and you reach 18, I just wonder whether you begin to not, you don't hang around the local community center. You don't hang around some of these places that where older people are quite familiar with. You're not a neighborhood type. You're not. It's an interesting cultural question why it's harder for younger people to vote. I think we got to get to that and why we can make it easier, how we can make it easier.
Well, and in addition to that, Biden has to get them excited, right? And the one place that he's been weak so far that people, you know, David Plouffe, the Obama strategist, and I spoke a few weeks ago, and he was saying that Biden needs to break through on the social media game. He needs to get stronger online. He can't look like a, you know, a hostage in the basement. He's got to connect, right? And you know, the power of social media, I know. And it's changed the game in some ways. There are constituencies out there. This is how they connect. This is how they absorb the world, you know. Have you gotten your head around that? Have you wrapped your head around
I've done the podcast and, you know, I tweeted last week on Easter and the Passover, and I understand the power. Yeah. Tweeting is something that we did at work all the time. I had a guy who was a specialist in it, and we were tweeting almost all the time. I think we're going to have to see. I think politically, it's an organizational tool that's extraordinary. I mean, if you're running for state rep or even U.S. Congress, you can organize your day around. I mean, it is one great opening for people of limited money. I mean, if you're a college professor or a student even, and you go, wait a minute, you know, I want to run for state rep. Okay, that's a reasonable-sized constituency. I'm going to every day, I'm going to walk the district. I'm going to meet people. And then every day I'm going to converse on social media. I'm going to tell people who I met, what I learned from them. I'm going to keep everybody working for me, the dozens of people working for me. I'm going to keep them up to date and communicate with them. It is a door. I've thought about this. A way you can actually run a campaign without a lot of money by building an organization that replicates the old political machines in big cities where you had ward leaders and you had committee men, committee people, and precinct captains. And you can really create something relatively free. And I think Bernie's done that. And I think that organizing platoons of people to get out and people to get the people to what's called polling operations. In the end, that's what we were talking about a few minutes ago. In the end, you got to pull the voters. You can't just keep them involved intellectually or back and forth tweeting. You got to get them pulled to the voting booth in the electoral states, because that's how it's done. And a lot of traditional politics, by the way, still works. We can't go and say everything is social media now, because Trump won. If you listen to David Orban, or Urban rather, Pennsylvania, he ran the Trump campaign in Pennsylvania. He was Arlen Specter's top guy. And he said it was coming down, it came down to the simple thing of the old Woody Allen thing of showing up. If you can show up in Erie, show up in Lehigh Valley, in Wilkes-Barre, places like that. If you show up and you're there with a crowd and the other candidate does not show up, you can win. And so a lot of the campaigning is going to be a challenge. If we don't have a second wave, maybe we'll be out there with crowds again by October. But don't underestimate showing up. I mean, Hillary Clinton missed the ball, I think, on that in some cases. And at least they'll argue that it had to do with media, Minnesota media that worked its way into Wisconsin. Some pretty smart moves that had nothing to do with Trump's personality or politics that were pretty, just like Obama's techniques under Plouffe were brilliant.
Right.
And, there's always going to be a new, there's always a new frontier, a new frontier of what we're going to say. Well, sometime you and I are talking this October, November 15th, we'll say, well, what was the new thing this election? What we learned was, and it will be, you know, how can Biden schmooze on social media? It's probably the question you've been asking now. How does he shift?
Well, and that's what I'm kind of getting at. And he needs to look like, you know, if Hillary Clinton didn't look like she wanted to be there when she was at a rally because she wasn't, this retail politicking wasn't her thing. Well, Biden needs to look like he wants to be there in the social media world. And I one observation I'm going to make, and this is going to lead to my next question, is whenever Jill is next to him on camera, he looks like he wants to be there. There's an energy that she brings into it.
Well,
you know,
let me talk
suddenly
about
there's another person in the room.
Let me talk about Jill, because I talked about an untapped resource, political resource. I watched her introduce him down near the Rocky statue in Philadelphia, the Art Museum, when he announced his campaign. It was blazing hot summer, and I'm standing there in the bullpen there, pretty close. She came in. Now, he walks fast. I think it's an older guy's way of showing he's young, walking fast. But she comes in. She's very young. She just seems young. And she comes pulverizing, hits that stand, that microphone, and just wows the crowd. It was all power, 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 strength, right. Belief. And she's from Willow Grove, Pennsylvania, right outside Philly, right near where I went to high school. And I don't know why she's not doing what, you know, Michelle Obama has been doing the last couple of years. I mean, getting out there, I don't quite get it. She's a regular person who built her own career as an educator, as a doctorate. I mean, she's very impressive and younger than him. And that's a fact, and it is a factor. Right. And strength. I think she shows his strength. I think people do. There's no doubt people do reflect each other's spouses. I mean, there's no doubt that when you meet someone, you meet the other person, you go, yeah, well, that tells me something I didn't know. It's always true.
Right.
The spouse tells you something about the other person. And she tells you the guy's got something, that he's gung-ho, he's worth being loyal to. He's a worthy hero, if you will. Now, Biden's problem, you know, he's been in Boston since 1972. He was elected on what we call a drop. It was, since they don't have TV in Delaware, they had the Philadelphia market, he put out a tabloid. And it was the best, John Martillo did it out of Massachusetts. It was a tabloid that looks like the Daily News. And on the cover of it, a lot of white space, it said, Joe Biden's making an impact in the U.S. Senate and hasn't even been elected here. And there's a 29-year-old guy who's losing his hair. He's young. He's a young lawyer, basically, who looked like a sacrificial lamb. He ran against a two-term governor, two-term senator, three-time congressman. He wasn't going to beat this guy, Caleb Boggs. But this ad showed him on each page sitting with somebody like Phil Hart or Scoop Jackson or Hubert Humphrey talking the issues in some senatorial background in the Senate building somewhere in the Capitol. And it got to 250,000 people that weekend before the election. Handed out. I'm telling you, he won on that. So talk about the old media. He won on newsprint, okay? All right? He didn't win with television. And so here he is in 2020, in a digital age, trying to get into digital. And he can hire the people like Pluff. Hopefully he can find people pretty good at it. But you're right. You're into what we're doing right now is different. It's different than TV. It's more intimate. It's more one-to-one. You watch it when you want to watch. You listen to it when you want to listen to it. Like my daughter's a Stanford business grad. And I got to tell you, I went to Kennedy School and everything and Penn, all that before that. And she's starting her own big business, and she's in the media. She doesn't get newspapers, papers at all. She's in the social media all day long, and her boyfriend, her fiance. This is and my son Thomas is like this. You know, I'm the guy that gets up in the morning and loves to read the Washington Post in print all the way through. I like to read the New York Times all the way through. I mean, in print. I think the advantage of that kind of newspaper reading, by the way, to make a case for the old school, and it is my case. You get to get a lot of peripheral vision when you read the paper like that. You're looking at stuff, what's happening in Pakistan, what's happening in South Africa today with coronavirus. I mean, you're learning stuff you're not going to go look up on purpose. You're not going to target it, but you're going to learn it. And that's the great thing about the broadsheet. You're digging it up because it's coming into your face, and you're learning things that way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a lot of, like, myopia in the new media, for sure.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Let me ask you something just on that front. We were talking about, you know, the effect of Jill and why she's not out there. But, you know, the next sort of shoe to drop here is that Biden's going to pick a VP. And, you know, I'm curious as to is that going to fix some of his problems? And who do you like for that for a VP? What
well,
do you
just remember?
You know,
remember the doctor's code. What is it? Do no harm. Yeah. Never forget that. VPs. Sarah Palin, Spiro Agnew, Dan Quayle. You got to be really careful because it can hurt. It can make a statement about you. It's your first, as you said, it's your first big choice. It's your vector.
Right.
It says where you're going. If you say, so Biden's problem is he picks someone at the center left, described by the media as, I don't like the way, I think Biden's a liberal, but the New York Times style book now says he's a moderate and people for Bernie are liberals. I think that's a misstatement, but I think Bernie is a man of the Democratic left, and he's proud of it, and he says that. And Biden is a liberal. And a liberal is always a balancing act between free enterprise or capitalism and the government role, the public role. And that's always been a balancing act. And it's trickier. It's harder to be in the middle there. Right? So does he want to pick somebody like himself, someone that looks like him politically, Amy Klobuchar, safe, Minnesota went by Trump by 1.5 points. She might be able to bring in Minnesota, help in the Midwest. She's definitely Midwestern. She's very top quality. I think as a candidate, she's been proven, vetted. I think that's in Pennsylvania, no problem, I don't think. So looks like she could be president if necessary, but not determined to have the office right away kind of thing. It's very tricky when you have a president who will be in his 80s. Half his first term or his only term, perhaps, and to pick the other person that's too ready to be president. You want somebody who's willing to be vice president for a while, you know, be vice president not look like it's just the guy's a lame duck and I'm ready to take over. Kamala Harris.
You don't think he needs to. You don't think he needs to pick somebody who's going to kind of cover that Bernie constituency and kind of assuage that.
Who would that be?
Maybe Elizabeth Warren.
I don't think I'll pick Warren.
Yeah.
No, I don't think I'll pick Warren. No. I think Massachusetts is already in the bag. And
Stacey Abrams.
No, I don't think so. I think he's going to have to pick somebody. He might, because she'll be very comfortable. And she would do okay in Pennsylvania, I think, too. I'm just thinking of Pennsylvania. A state you have to win. I think she's very, I think, very appealing as a human being. I don't know if she has enough status in terms of electoral office. There's nobody perfect.
Right.
I look at Whitmer. Whitmer is a new person with all the surprise factor of a new person. A governor, I think that's very important to have somebody with executive ability in this time when the governors all look really good. I think Michigan would be a plus.
Right.
I guess I've been giving a lot of thought to Whitmer as a little more aggressive move. And I'll go back to this. Biden has to look like, if it's a horse and rabbit stew, he has to look like the horse, not the rabbit. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yep.
He can't look like he's the rabbit in the stew and the left is the horse, or then he looks like he's not his own person. You've got to be strong. And he has to say, right. I believe in student loan breaks. The people are certain. I'm going to means test it, though. unlike Bernie. I'm going to means test to 125 or whatever, but I'm going to means test it. People have debts that don't make it a super income, but I'm going to groom it and I'm going to make it my own. And I do believe we have to give kids, young people in their 20s and 30s, of course, once they graduate, we got to give these young adults the money they need to get started so they're not strapped from the beginning. And I also think
now more than ever,
you made a while ago, this new monetary policy has won. There's an argument that's won. Because if the federal government can print money in the trillions, basically we're doing this huge printing of money where we're monetizing the debt, where you're increasing the money supply to account for the more spending by the government. Well, that makes the case of the people on the left who argue we do have a chance for a new monetary policy. We can do it without inflation, but we'll see. We'll see.
Right. Yeah.
If there isn't going to be inflation. Who knows? But I think the idea of paying student debt is something that Biden is comfortable with. He still wants to go with lowering the eligibility for Medicare rather than a national health care system. He wants a public option. He's just going to sell with brio, because these are all moves to the social side of things, to the left, and they could be sold as very strong progressive moves without sounding like he's buckling. You don't want to look like – you can't look like you're buckling, because then Trump will just run against him as he's Bernie's errand boy. You know what Trump will do.
That's right.
And I think this is going to matter in the burbs in Philly, where they're worried about taxation. And it's going to, in the cultural parts of the state, where they're much more pro-gun, more individualist and traditional in their values. It's always going to be an approach pro-life in many ways. I mean, Bobby Casey, the Democratic Senator from Pennsylvania, is pro-life. There's a lot of pro-life cultural feelings about and they like Biden, even though he switched on the, on the Hyde Amendment. But Biden has to remain true to who Biden is, too. And I think he's going to have to be more Harry Truman than Dick Sixon.
Yeah, he may be the, auto union came out and endorsed Biden. He's got a connection to the working class, and maybe there's
a
chance
a
he can deliver.
That goes back to Pennsylvania, too. If you're a Pennsylvania politician who is popular in Pennsylvania, it's a labor state, like San Francisco is a labor city, and in places they're just pro-labor. They should be pro-labor. And these guys are very aware of what their core rating is, what rating they're getting from the AFL-CIO voting record. And they want 100%. And so he will know things like the labor law issues, Situs picketing, all these different things, and card check. I bet you Biden knows all that stuff cold. I mean, Jerry Brown out in California knew that stuff cold. There's such a thing as a labor guy or labor Democrat who doesn't come across as left, but is very pro-labor. Bob Casey, I mentioned, in Pennsylvania, totally pro-labor. Because that's
who
people
my
are.
My point was that
that's who they are.
He can, some of these positions that might have seemed ultra-liberal at one time, maybe he's the messenger for those, given his connection to the working class. I mean, it's a little bit about talking about student debt and talking about healthcare as working class issues. And he's got the sort of bona fides to...
Let me tell you how the difference I look at it. And explains my attitude, I think, towards Senator Sanders. I think if you talk politics from a kitchen table point of view, like what people need, and you talk about what people really need in life, the Democratic Party is not like the British Labor Party. It's not anti-rich people. It's mainly about economic and social security, and keeping their families together. I'm talking about Pennsylvania. I'm talking about Scranton. I'm talking Erie. I'm talking people. They want Social Security because they earned it. They worked from the times they're 15 paying in this payroll taxes. They want Medicare because they earned it. They worked for 50 years. So that if they survive, the male especially survives, you might get 15 years of health coverage that he earned. Same with Medicaid, because people who have long-term care problems and families are all vulnerable to Alzheimer's and dementia. They need it for long-term care, and they want that. What else do they want? They want their young children, as they go into middle age, they want them to be able to work close enough they can come home once in a while by car. They don't want them heading up into Silicon Valley or New York or somewhere. They want them to live near enough home that they come home once in a while. That is about it. Now, you enlarge the social, stretch out the social safety net, and something like the public option. I think Biden's very comfortable with that. It's a public option to compete with private insurance. Outlawing a private insurance seems a little dictatorial. Outlawing it doesn't sound right. Right. We don't outlaw anything, right. Really. We don't even outlaw a private health insurance. What kind of a country is that where you can't even choose to buy a policy if you can afford it? But the public option seems to be a movement. But, you know, you got to keep the balance between individual freedom and the social safety net. And that's how this country has worked for all these years, a combination of a market-based economy with a pretty good growing social system that supports. That's what they basically have in the northern countries in Europe, too. A little more than that. They don't have a big military to support like we do in an entitlement bill every year we have to pay, or a debt we have to service. That's something nobody's talked about. All this money the government's borrowing, okay.
Yeah.
They can monetize it. They can print the money. But in the end, they got to pay it back at market rates. People that buy T-bonds and paper are going to get their interest. It's a fact. I don't know how that's going to, but it just means a bigger chunk of the federal budget is going to three things: entitlements, paying off the debt, and the military. And the public gets none of that. And they go, wait a minute, what are we getting out of that? And that makes it harder for liberal or left politicians to argue for more government because people say, I'm not getting anything out of this. So that's going to be a challenge down the road, this debt. It is, because it already has been.
Right. So, you know, let's talk about Trump for a minute.
Anyway, I think the kitchen table approach, the social and economic security, is always going to sell better with me than the ideological approach. If you start with me with the ideological, I'm a socialist, I want to believe in government doing stuff, I trust the government to do all this stuff, I don't want a lot of individual freedom out there to make these decisions, I want the government to make the decisions, no choice about health care, no, that's not going to sell with me. I want a free society that has a good social safety net. And I think you can have both together if you're not ideological about it.
Right. And in that way, are you comfortable with Joe Biden as the vessel for that message?
He's got to prove himself. The campaign is ahead for him. And I think, to go back to where we started, if you look at the numbers, Trump's 46% job approval. Disapproval 51. You get through the electoral college, that's about a wash. So Biden has to beat Trump. Okay, he's got to beat him.
That's the bottom line.
Stronger in the debates. He's got to have a better social media thing. As you've been talking about, a basic national television ad campaign, he's got to get out there and rally people and get people to the rallies, center left and left, and some on the center right. He's got to get some center right votes. He has to. He has to get them. And the unhappy Republicans who vote for people like Larry Hogan and Troy Baker and people like that and Mike DeWine, he's got to get some of those votes. He's going to lose if he's done.
For sure.
But he's got to, he needs, I don't know if he has that, I don't know if he has the campaign. I know you're getting at this, and I don't think it's ideological. I think it's, does he have a campaign on the level of a level, say, Obama or Bill Clinton? The winners.
Right.
Does he have a
winning
campaign?
Want him to be, you want to have his identity in this race be distinct. I think of Trump, you know, recently comparing himself to Captain Bligh in Mutiny on the Bounty, right? He's casting the governors as these mutineers and, you know, kind of a bizarre comparison since Captain Bligh was kind of a villain.
Yeah, well, we used to say on the show, when we had a troubled guest, it was just a real problem that didn't deliver or something, we'd say, he's in the boat. You don't want to be in the boat. I mean, that was where Captain Bligh was put, in that boat. He was on the ship, then he was put in the boat, from the Bounty to the boat.
Yeah, right.
But he did survive. It was men against the sea. He did make it back to London, but you don't want to be in that boat.
So throw me some, you know, what kind of film protagonist do we want Joe Biden to be? What does he need to be? Put him in a movie, you know?
Kevin Kline was pretty good in Dave, as the pony president, the imitator. That's a great question. You know, when Joseph Alsop wrote this thing, I've always remembered about FDR. He said, you know, in the days after Pearl Harbor, when I was in Hong Kong, and the Japanese were bombing us, and I was in the mainland part of China, right across that little Cholana, what it's called. And I was over there, and I was lying on the floor of my apartment, and the bombs were dropping. The Japanese were bombing. I knew that Roosevelt would win the war. You know, Joe, that kind of personal confidence in the leader, the leader will get us through. This guy will get us through. For a while in the primary, I thought all that people knew when it was a designated driver, just somebody to get us home safely.
Right.
But now I think people want a little better than a designated driver. They want to have someone who can command the helm and make the big decisions in the interest of the country. Right. And the general welfare, looking out for the vulnerable, but also being concerned about keeping our economy from dying, not going into a stall that we can't get out of. It's going to take a leader, you know, and we got to see if Biden's up to it.
Yeah.
I know that Trump is up to a certain kind of leader, a more willful, more ruthless even, a leader willing to take casualties. It's going to be one heck of a choice.
You know, I was reading some passages from your first book. Of course, it was called Hardball. It was 1988, right?
Right.
You tell stories of Johnson, Nixon, Kennedy, your time with Tip O'Neill, and it's sort of like inside the game, the Machiavellian sport of politics, which became your calling card for, you know, the last many years on cable news. And now here we are years later. The warp and woof of history has taken us into all kinds of unimaginable places, but we've got Trump, right? He's like the political id, in some ways the ultimate hardballer. And he blew up the game. You know, the last 3 years, it's been his world that we've all been living in. And, you know, Biden says,
if you read my definition of hardball, it's clean, aggressive, Machiavellian politics. It's clean and it's aggressive, but it's clean. It starts with that word. And
clean.
I think clean, and I think Trump breaks some rules that some people think the end justifies the means, and I know people like that. They just say, "Oh, if we do this, we'll get what we want." And when you start with basic making fun of people's faces, making fun of people's looks, making fun of people's handicaps, trashy human beings, and I think that if we say we're happy with a leader like that, we got a problem. And anyway, those basic moral behavior questions about Trump, I mean, they're not going away. And in the way he talks to reporters with complete disdain and actual hostility. And the word fake media should not be laughed at. It should not be accepted because he said that to Leslie Stahl years ago. Why do you say fake media? He says, because then when I'm wrong, basically, I can get away with it. They won't believe the people, the reporters. And one thing I do, it's not about opinion or cable or interpretive or analysis, what I think I'm good at. It's the straight reporter that goes out and covers the news and comes back. And I used to sit on the buses with those people, the Times, the Journal, and those people like that in the Post. And I marvel at their ability to put together a 1,500 piece with a lead and then with a big jump. All factual, all checked out, back with the desks, with their editors. And it was, we in this country have that kind of media, which we know is trying to get it right. And I think that we should never devalue that. The people that are really trying to get it straight, I work with these people. I know them, people on NBC News, the news division. They really try to get it straight, this is something we got to treasure. And I'm even asked by speech, but my daughter-in-law is on the reporters committee working on this full time. That's what she does to protect the rights of reporters, my daughter-in-law. And, we got to believe in it, Joe.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, Biden's message at the outset of his campaign was, you know, Trump has to be an outlier or that's the end, right? He's painting a pretty dark portrait of what happens if Trump is reelected. And my question for you originally was, you know, have the rules of the game changed? I mean, can we put the genie back in the bottle and have people, you know, trust factual information ever again? I mean, that's the sort of terrifying lack of ground we find under our feet in this moment.
I agree with that. And let me tell you, Trump may have met his match with Dr. Tony Fauci, Anthony Fauci, who I've known forever. He goes to my church. He went to my college. He's always been Tony Fauci. He is the stalwart. He stands up. He delivers the truth. Trump better not mess with him. And I tell you, because in the end, that guy standing next to Trump is all he's got. Because then it is complete political talk if without him standing there. Ironically, he needs him. And,
right.
You know, we've had people in our government over the years who've run NASA, who run programs that really matter, FEMA, and they're not political. No, FEMA is not a good example. NASA is a good example of people that just do the work and get the job done and can be responsible for incredible enterprises. And I got to believe that that deep state matters, and I'm for it. I think that is what Trump's afraid of, and that's why he keeps attacking it. But the experts are going to get us through this thing. And it is going to come down to testing. It's going to come down to a vaccine at some point. And Trump's not going to invent the vaccine. He's not going to come up with adequate testing. He's throwing that to the states. I am impressed, though, that public service seems to look pretty good right now with the governors. And public service at the level of New York State and Albany and Sacramento and Columbus, you know, and Lansing, it looks like people are actually coming to the fore and rising to the occasion. I think it's so true about these governors when they're running at 80 and 90% job approval. And part of that's because they got the real responsibility. Their states, they don't just set speed limits. They determine what our education systems are, what our marriage laws are, I mean, what our drug laws are, our alcohol. Just everything in our life is so much controlled by the public safety responsibilities of a governor. And we're learning that in our federal system. And thank God we've got people at the state governorships, like Wolf of Pennsylvania, all these people have all seemed to have risen to the occasion. And I think that's a pretty good indicator where normal will look like when we get back to it. One of these governors may be the next president.
That's right. And I also notice on the media side, Chris, that, you know, the highest rated news show on TV right now is a network news program. You know, you're getting people going, rushing back to what people thought was a dead institution, which is the evening news. I think that, you know, people are looking for some sort of security in their information because now it's a life or death thing, right? You can't trust all
I think the ideal of the objective, the truly objective, is always has to be reason. I mean, Cronkite was a liberal. He would have told you that. People knew he was a liberal, but people believed he had the facts. They knew his point of view. You know, and when he said the Vietnam War wasn't working, we weren't going to win. It was going to be a draw at best. People believed him, not because he had a lot of opinions before that, but because he withheld his opinions before that.
Yeah.
As somebody said, you only get one card at that. You get one card at expressing your opinion. The rest of the time, you better be fact-driven. Although I got to tell you, in all the years I did hardball, and one thing we were heat-seeking. I don't doubt it. I would never deny that we didn't look for excitement and cover the biggest story that was hottest that night. We always went for that. I always said, dessert first. This is where we're going. Go with the story people are talking about right now at 7 o'clock. Don't go to another story. Don't say, eat your vegetables now. We'll get to the meat. No, let's get to the meat right now. And I think we were always fact-driven. I always say to the producer, who told you that? Where'd you get that from? Where'd that come from? I want to know it before I get on the air. And don't tell me something while I'm on the air, because then we haven't had time to check it. So I think fact-driven is very important for any medium, even opinion journalism needs facts.
Right.
And the best columnists today are the ones who have facts in their columns, news reporting. That's true.
Right. They make some calls.
Make some calls.
Chris, you've been home for the last 51 days like the rest of us, staying put. How you biding your time off air? I mean, has it been tough?
I've got a big book, Joe, with Simon & Schuster due next February. I had about half of it done, about 70,000 words. These words are going to have to be pruned down, but 70,000 words in by the beginning of the year. I'm going to finish by the end of this month, I hope, what I call the third book of the four books I'm writing. They're all part of one memoir. And I'm up to 1977 up to 80 through the Carter administration, where I was a speechwriter for the president. I'm writing about that period now. So I had the first quarter of the book was all about being raised Catholic in the 50s, which was something, being an older boy, including at an insane asylum at a mental institution. I mean, all this stuff I did as a kid. And then a huge 20, 25,000 words on just Africa for 2 years, working and teaching in Africa, and then working my way home through Africa, and then working on a hill, Capitol Police, U.S. Senate Legislative Aid, Senate Budget with Muskie, running for Congress in the Democratic primary in Philly, being a presidential speechwriter with Carter, going through all that with him, then becoming top aide to Tip O'Neill for 6 years. I hope to get all that done by the end of May or early June. And then I started the journalism when I started in 87 with the San Francisco Examiner, and then all through the covering of the Berlin Wall coming down and its first elections in South Africa, the Irish peace talks in Northern Ireland, the Good Friday, all that stuff going into Hardball. And so there's a lot of it in there, a lot of work. And that, every day I get up and I worry, what can I do now to speed the plow and keep this moving? I got another book that's being made into a limited series, but I'll talk about that some other time. I'm writing. I'm writing. I'm running. I walk every day about 3 miles.
A year, and you're in Maryland, is that right?
I'm about 2 blocks from D.C. I can look down the road and see D.C. But it's a nice neighborhood. I love it up there. No, I've enjoyed this.
So listen.
Time with my family.
I'm glad, and I've appreciated, you know, all your insights and your candid approach. I always have. And one thing I got to say is you have almost 1 million followers on Twitter. Yeah. And you've tweeted once since you left MSNBC. And that was on Easter. It got 21,000 likes. That's not bad. Are you going to tweet more? Why not use this platform?
Well, let me think about it. I wanted to respect what happened to me and respect the report of what I said, complimenting the woman at the time. And I didn't want to make it seem like I didn't. I did take it seriously, and I acted on it, and I wanted to show a little respectful time here, but I want to get back into writing and probably get whatever opportunities come along to get on TV and talk about politics. Because I get up every morning and I'm still absorbed in it and mentally, and I might as well make use of it. And I've gotten a lot of wonderful letters from people. I'm sure some don't agree, but the number of hundreds of people have written these wonderful letters, and young people who I've been mentoring, I didn't even know I was mentoring, but young men and women have written me the most so affectionate, nice letters about what I did, talk about how to be on television, what it was like as a journalist at the report in quick bites and sharp bottom lining of things. And I've been very happy with that, with the reaction, obviously. But people say they miss me. I mean, I miss them too.
Yeah.
C'est la vie.
Well, listen, Chris Matthews, thank you so much for taking the time today. I know a lot of people are going to be interested to hear what you think, because you haven't been out there saying it, and I think they're gonna want to hear it, and it's interesting. So,
okay,
and I
so
appreciate all the historical context.
Joe, I'm going to say it's Biden and a close match, but highly unpredictable. But it, probably Biden. I'd be more surprised by a Trump victory than a Biden victory. I think it looks like Klobuchar could be the one for the geography and the person. And for Pennsylvania and the Midwestern states, I think she makes the most sense. I think Biden has to absorb to his heart some of these progressive programs to his heart. He has to bring them in, not just say it. And they can't just be on the platform. They have to be him. And yet he has to be the boss. He's the candidate. I think Senator Sanders knows that. He's respected that. He's respecting him as the candidate, and I think he's done a very good job, he's played a very generous role in helping Biden get this thing won.
Yeah, I agree. That is, so there you hear it. That's the prediction. Chris and Matthew, we're going to see, in this projection, we have Biden and Amy Klobuchar and Biden stepping up to be the field general. So we'll see if that happens.
We'll see if it happens. We'll see. Thank you.
Take care, man. And that was our show for the week. I'd like to thank Chris Matthews for coming on the program. And of course, thank my fabulous co-host, Emily Jane Fox. You can follow us both on Twitter Emily Jane Fox and Joe Higgins says. And if you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive. You can find those on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And please don't forget to leave a review. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13, especially Bob Tabador, our executive producer, for their production work. And thanks, of course, to my sponsors. Please support them the way they support this podcast. And we'll see you next week.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.